We're going to end this hour with a little Beck. He's got a new album out, but let's start with some early Beck back in the 90s when he came out with what must be the ultimate slacker tune.
In the time of chimpanzees, I was a monkey. Butane in my veins and a mouth to cut the chuggy with the plastic eyeballs. Spray paint the vegetables, dog food skulls with the beefcake pantyhose.
Beck Hansen was more awkward, skinny white kid than rock star. And his quirky classic Loser introduced listeners to his most endearing quality, humor. Much of his early work is infused with a sharp comic tone. Think songs with titles like Sissy Neck and Satan Gave Me a Taco. In the last few years, Beck's records have become more serious. His latest, Modern Guilt, may be his darkest yet. When Beck sat down with us to talk about his work, he said it's not that he sees things differently. It's just that when he was starting out, his first instinct was always to go for a laugh.
I came out of playing in coffee houses and bars. So really, just as a performer, that was kind of a survival mechanism. Usually I was the first band or playing in between the bands that people actually came to see. So the humor was something that just sort of helped me get people's attention, I guess.
How you like me now?
Pretty good.
Going on, feeling strong. I quit my job blowing leaves. Telephone bills up my sleeves.
A lot of the songs were written about people that I knew, usually neighbors that I had. I had some pretty eccentric neighbors, and a lot of what I encountered in life at the time went right into the songs.
And they were thinking like this. Why don't go in prison, got the song?
Your new CD suggests you're in something of a different place from certainly your earlier work, but even your last couple of projects. Let's play one song, Volcano.
Okay, yeah.
Which
this
is indicative.
This one's pretty serious, yeah.
I don't know what I've seen. Was it all an illusion, a mirage gone bad? Many of these songs, in fact, most of the lyrics have some are depressed. Some seem as if the narrator is anxious.
Yeah.
The title track, Modern Guilt, it really exemplifies that.
I feel uptight when I walk in the city. I feel so cold when I'm at home. Feels like everything's starting to hurt me. I lost my bearing 10 minutes ago.
So you can tap along with it,
but
a kind of a complicated mixed message as a piece.
Yeah, the way a lot of my songs are written, I write the music first and I record it, and then with a song like Modern Guild, I just get on the microphone and I write something really quick, sort of off the top of my head, so I can remember the melody. And what happens a lot of times is that what I initially sing on there ends up being on the record. A lot of these things, I don't really get to spend too much time figuring out what it is.
Mother gives all in our hands. Mother guilt won't get me to bed.
Sometimes when you record something and write something off the cuff like that, you'll say things that are a bit more simple or more direct, and simpler lyrics work better, I think, melodically. Unless you're doing a talking blues or rap, which I think is one of the things that first attracted me to. I mean, I wouldn't claim that it's rap. It's spoken, you know, whatever, a song like Where It's At. Or
and why wouldn't you claim it's
'cause
rap?
Because, you know, it doesn't come from hip-hop. You know, I used to hang out with a lot of poets and people who did spoken word, you know. So I think I thought my rap, quote, rap songs were coming from that.
There's a destination a little up the road from the habitations of the towns we know.
a place we saw the lights turn low, the jigsaw jazz in the get fresh flow.
And my grandfather was an artist, and he came up in New York in the 40s and 50s, and he spoke in that kind of zoot suit hipster lingo of that time, you know, the beats, and
let's
I think I had a lot of influence from him.
Let's talk about him for a moment. His name is Al Hanton, and
yeah,
by the 60s, he was an artist who was leading a school of art. People would know Yoko Ono. Of all those probably artists, she's obviously the most famous.
Yeah, that's the Fluxus movement. He passed away when I was in my early 20s, so I never really got to sit down and ask him about all these things. But I definitely remember the way he talked.
How did he talk?
He had a lot of made-up words, or what seemed to be made-up words. He was just riffing all the time. You know, it was a broken-down traffic miasma. We boogied uptown over here and whatnot and this and that, and it was just all rolling off of his tongue.
Pick yourself up off the side of the road with the elevator bones and your whiplash tones. Members only, hypnotizers move through the room like ambulance drivers.
Well, one thing those artists did, they made collages and assemblages. It did occur to me that it's something like what you've done in music.
Well, yeah, he liked to say that he was an alchemist. But really it was that he was broke. He couldn't afford art materials, so I think he decided early on, I'm going to make art out of what I have around. So it was candy wrappers and cigarette butts. And when I was a child, he used to send us to the garbage can. When we were at a restaurant, we'd go to all the ashtrays that were left. We used to collect all the cigarette butts for him, for his artwork.
Have you ever written a song with your grandfather in mind? He sounds like such a character.
I don't think I have, no. I mean, he's in there somewhere. I think I have an assignment now.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, no, it was a pleasure.
And you can hear full songs from Beck's new album Modern Guilt at NPR Music on npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. This is the day the College Board releases its annual report on how high school students performed on the SAT test. A year ago, less than one half of 1% of students got a perfect score, 2,400, in the combined math, verbal, and writing sections. It's hard not to be impressed when somebody does that, but there is a school where this happens with regularity. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports on how they do it.
There's a small high school program in Baltimore, Maryland, where getting perfect SAT scores has become, well, kind of old hat.
Excuse me. I'm looking for the folks in the Ingenuity Project.
It's next door, 37.
Okay, thank you.
Housed in Baltimore's Polytechnic Institute, the Ingenuity Project has attracted some of the city's brightest public school students. Since 2001, the program has produced 13 perfect SAT scores, and one man gets lots of the credit.
My name is Michael Goldenberg, and I was born in Ukraine.
Goldenberg, a gifted mathematician, once taught mathematics in Moscow's best schools. He emigrated to the U.S., settled in Baltimore, and was hired by the Ingenuity Project in 1997. Here, Goldenberg has mentored several students who got perfect SAT scores, although truth be told, he doesn't think much of the SAT.
It's extremely easy.
Maybe, compared to the rigorous coursework students here take. Beginning in 9th and 10th grade, advanced calculus, trigonometry, physics, advanced biology, chemistry, technology, and the classics and literature. On the other hand, says Goldenberg, the SAT is a measure of a student's patience, persistence, even maturity.
And that is why, finally, I like the test. It's a good predictor of how developed the person is.
Well-rounded, says Goldenberg. That's a better word. One student immediately comes to mind, Robert Watkins III. He had a perfect score back in 2001 when the SAT still had two sections worth 1,600.
There was nothing on it like we didn't know.
Watkins credits Professor Goldenberg and the academic rigor and challenging work at the Ingenuity Project.
As far as the perfect score thing, I mean, it's a lot about how well you take tests, but it shouldn't be the be-all and end-all of, like, you know, predicting what someone's future will be or what they'll do.
What Robert did was go on to Yale, then law school at Columbia University. Now he's a patent lawyer in New York City. Did Robert's SAT score help open each one of these doors? Absolutely, says Seppi Bazzilli, an expert with Kaplan, the test preparation company. But, he adds, we've gone overboard attaching a lot of other things that the SAT just doesn't measure.
We've heard about investment banks that ask you for your SAT scores, and my mom, who's a realtor, makes sure that on the front brochure of her hometown, she proudly displays the average SAT score of the local high school, because we're obsessed with numbers. I mean, the SAT, it's really only designed to do one thing, to tell colleges how students will do in their first year of college.
And that's it.
And that's it.
And even that, experts say, is debatable. So it's unlikely we'll ever know if success on the SAT has anything to do with success in life. Still, at the Ingenuity Project, this year there's a 10th grader who's already gotten a perfect 800 on the math section of the SAT. And no one at the school is about to play that down. After all, she could be the next perfect 2400. Claudio Sanchez, NPR News.
Walmart created a stir a couple of years ago when it announced it was moving into the organic food market. Now the nation's top grocery seller is promoting its locally grown produce. The company touts the community benefits, but it's also a way for Walmart to cut down on fuel costs. Reporter Jenny O'Mara from member station KXJZ in Sacramento has more.
Some things you can expect to see at any Walmart you go to.
Okay, thank you for shopping Walmart. You have a nice day.
But at this West Sacramento Supercenter, there's something different. The produce area is covered with bright green and white signs, highlighting products that are California grown. Walmart says partnerships with local farmers have grown 50% over the past 2 years, and not just in California, but in Walmart stores across the country. This year, it plans to buy about $400 million of locally grown produce. Walmart spokeswoman Tiffany Moffitt says the primary benefit to the company is savings on fuel costs to the tune of millions of dollars a year. Local partnerships have become the company's latest PR mantra.
It's estimated that in the United States, produce travels an average of 1,500 miles from farms to homes of consumers. So it just provides us an opportunity to make products closer to home and buy local.
But the retailer's definition of what constitutes locally grown doesn't match the one promoted by many in the so-called local food movement. You'll find many of them at local farmers markets.
This is a scene usually associated with that local food movement, organic produce, small farmers, some who truck their products just a dozen or so miles down the road. That's not exactly what Walmart is talking about.
This is a weekly Saturday morning farmers market in Sacramento. Farmer Patrick Hoover is ladling blueberries into small plastic boxes and offering samples. He's driven less than 50 miles from his 40 acres up in the foothills to sell them. And that's what most locavores, the fans of locally grown food, say is real local food. Walmart says, on the other hand, anything grown in the same state is local food. Hoover says selling to Walmart doesn't really appeal to him.
The quality I have, I don't do any markets like that just because my stuff is picked ripe and the only shelf I want it on is between here and the customer at home. And sitting in any retail store is just not good for my produce.
But farmers who sell at such markets acknowledge their products are usually more expensive than what you find in the stores, due in part to the additional labor involved. Many of Walmart's local producers are large-scale farmers that can supply in bulk. Saving on fuel costs is one of the benefits to Walmart of this new locally grown strategy, and it certainly benefits local farmers. But Professor Dan Sumner says if the company's strategy catches on nationwide, it could spell problems for a major growing state like California, where much is shipped elsewhere. Sumner teaches agricultural economics at UC Davis.
If people decide they're going to consume locally, that means they're probably not consuming our walnuts and apricots and almonds and everything else we grow around here.
Still, locally grown might not be that big a selling point for Walmart customers. Back in the produce aisle at the West Sacramento Walmart, the locally grown theme isn't having much impact on Thomas Teeny, who says for him, it's all about the household bottom line.
We're kind of on a tight budget right now, the whole economy. It's not really that great of importance to us. We just buy what's cheap.
For NPR News, I'm Jenny O'Mara in Sacramento.
The arrest of a library clerk in Alamance County, North Carolina, highlights two competing values. One is to enforce immigration laws. The other is to provide health care to those who need it. The 23-year-old was picked up after seeking medical care, and that's why the case raised fears that officials may be using health records to find and deport illegal immigrants. North Carolina Public Radio's Jessica Jones reports.
It's a hot summer night, and dozens of people have formed a circle outside the Alamance County Commission office.
Come join us. Let's get close enough so that we can hear each other.
Elon University's chaplain, Richard McBride, leads the group. One by one, they step to the center to speak, including Irene Godinez.
I'm thinking of my family who had to escape Mexico because there was no opportunity for prosperity and are now afraid to leave their house.
The group organized the vigil to protest the arrest of Marjavi Angel Martinez. She came to the U.S. from Mexico legally as a toddler with her parents, but they broke the law when they overstayed their visas. Jose Alegria is a Latino advocate in the county. He says immigration agents arrested Martinez at her job at the library.
In fact, she received medical care during her pregnancy. That is a fact. It is a fact that she was using someone else's social security number. Yes.
Martinez pleaded guilty to misuse of a social security number and is now in deportation proceedings. She wants to stay in the United States and will fight the charges. Her arrest came after some county leaders called for an investigation of the health department. They said illegal immigrants were draining the department's resources.
What is rare here is to then have information used to deport someone.
Pam Dixon is the executive director of the World Privacy Forum, a nonprofit group that researches privacy issues. She says it is legal for law enforcement officials to request health records as part of a healthcare investigation. But Dixon says using those records to make an arrest outside that realm is scary.
What you don't want to have is a system in which someone goes to a public health clinic and then that is used as a treasure trove of subpoena land. You do not want that.
Local officials won't say whether Martinez's health records led to her arrest, but a federal program called 287G allows local authorities to begin the deportation process. At a recent county commissioners meeting, Sheriff Terry Johnson told a crowded room he won't turn his back on violations of the law like identity theft.
And folks, I'm going to tell you something. I will not do it. I have not done it, and I'm not going to do it. If you want to come here illegally and live in this country, do not violate any laws.
After the meeting, Alamance County Health Director Barry Bass said he hasn't seen a decrease in patient visits, but he wouldn't say whether the move has discouraged immigrants to seek health care.
Everybody has to make a decision for themselves if they're comfortable receiving services.
What's happening in Alamance County worries doctors. Peter Morris is the medical director of one of North Carolina's largest network of clinics in Raleigh. He says if someone has an infectious disease and is scared to see a doctor, that affects everyone in the community.
If people come to our offices afraid that if they tell us something, that that information could be used against them, I think it will chill the relationship in the doctor's office, and that's something we all should fear.
Since charges were filed against Marjavi Angel Martinez, immigration authorities have also arrested her parents and her husband. They're facing deportation, too. For NPR News, I'm Jessica Jones in Durham, North Carolina.
Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep. People spend all that money on GPS directional systems, and it turns out all they need is a cow. Researchers say cattle seem to have some kind of internal compass. They studied satellite photos of thousands of cows around the world, and no matter which continent they're on, grazing or resting cows tend to align themselves north and south. So call it CPS. You can find your way as long as you know which end is north.
Now to a very different festive scene, a tradition each summer in New York City's Central Park. People line up for free theater. Some camp out all night to make sure they get a ticket. And this month, those lines have been huge. All the fuss is over a 40-year-old musical about a bunch of hippies. We're talking about Hair. NPR's Margot Adler got in line to find out if all the waiting is worth it.
Full disclosure, I didn't think this was a story until I spent 7 hours waiting for tickets and felt it was fun, relaxing, and totally worth it. People come with chairs, inflatable mattresses, picnic baskets, games, and some things you might never imagine. Michael James is an actor.
This is my third time seeing this production, yeah.
And have you been sitting on a line every single time?
Yeah.
This is how you spend your weekend.
This is how I spend my weekend.
And this is a common refrain. Marsha Berry is near the head of the line.
I got here at 20 after 3.
Oh, my God. And why did you decide to get here so early?
Because this is my fifth time seeing the show.
No.
And yes, yes. I saw it back in the 60s, and this show is a grillion times better. So I just can't see it enough, and I can't bring enough of my friends to see it.
Nombre mío es Miguel Rivera. Oh, I'm sorry, wrong language. My name is Miguel Rivera, and I've seen it twice already. This is my second time around. I enjoyed it very much. I'm looking forward to seeing it again today.
In the beginning, the line, which already stretches several city blocks, is quiet. Then out comes Zach Spicer, an actor working public theater security. He tells you the rules.
There is no swapping, cutting, changing places, or saving places in line. Also, second rule is now that you are here, and you must not leave. Do not go frolic in the park. Do not go to Starbucks. Since you cannot leave, we do have the number to a deli. It will deliver anything from breakfast sandwiches, coffee, newspapers, to kitty litter and bleach, whatever you guys want.
There is a public bathroom you can use. Within 30 minutes, bike messengers are passing down the line, calling out names with breakfast. Angus Killick is among the first to have his order arrive.
I ordered a bagel with cream cheese. A very New York breakfast, of course.
I'm Willie Williams. And I'm having a mouthful of bagels.
Other people brought their own spreads, from elaborate picnic baskets filled with home-cooked food to piles of donuts and boxes of Morning Joe. Of course, there's Scrabble, cards, books, knitting, and the Sunday Times. Garrett Rosso brought his dog.
This is Kai, the Rhodesian Ridgeback.
I assume that she doesn't get to see the show.
It's a hippie musical. She should be able to come. She probably barked.
Love is such a cost. Give me things that won't get tossed.
Mark Jacoby spent a half an hour stringing his guitar. Now he's playing it to people listening and sleeping nearby. Frank Silverberg, a financial advisor, sums it all up.
We sit and schmooze, get to meet all the people in the line, get to see a great show for free.
Who says there isn't community in New York City, at least through September 7th? Margot Adler, NPR News, New York.